this is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry. Happy New Year to everyone out there. Here at The Takeaway, we're ringing in the holiday by playing you a few of the pieces from this year that were so good we thought you needed to hear them again. Now, take a listen with me.
It's admitted in the Times, New York Times reports, or Time Magazine, that a recent survey shows that racism is broader and stronger than before. We're not gaining ground, my friends. We might be losing. But one thing I'm sure of, this is no time to stop.
These are the words of the Supreme Court's first black justice, Thurgood Marshall, as he accepted the Jurist of the 20th Century Award from the National Bar Association. The year was 1988. Nearly a half century earlier, in 1940, Marshall had founded the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. The storied civil rights organization has only had seven presidents. And like its founder, its current leader, Sherrilyn Ifill, is a civil rights superhero. So it was a bit of a surprise when Ifill recently announced that she would be stepping down from the helm of LDF. After all, this is a moment that could be described as Marshall characterized 1988.
We're not gaining ground, my friends. We might be losing.
But again, to quote Marshall, this is no time to stop. Enter the LDS, soon to be 8th president.
My name is Janae Nelson. I'm the Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
And as she gets ready to assume the role of leading the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, I asked Janae about the lessons she'll take from her predecessor, Sherrilyn Ifill, and the direction she hopes to build.
Sherrilyn has been such an amazing leader, and it's been just an incredible journey to be with her for the past 8 years, helping to build LDF's profile and make it even stronger than when we encountered it, and certainly than when she encountered it a year before I got there. I'm excited because I don't need to transform this institution with such a storied legacy. But I have an amazing foundation on which to build. There's so much work ahead of us. There are so many challenges. And we have a formidable and growing team of advocates and staff ranging from researchers to organizers to policymakers to help us lift this heavy load. And it's going to be, I think, a very critical period for the Legal Defense Fund because it is a critical period for our democracy. There are a lot of challenges ahead for us. And that's what we're, honing our skills and tools to face.
You know, as you talk about the challenges facing our democracy in this moment, the question of education and of an understanding of our history is a core challenge we're currently facing.
Absolutely. We are in the midst of a serious battle that is a fight for the soul of this country. And it centers around our ability to hear, access, and absorb the truth. We are seeing so many laws proliferate across the country that aim to keep the truth of our history, the truth of our current conditions, away from the next generation of residents of this country. And it is something that is core to civil rights work, even if it's not obvious on the face of it. If we can't tell our truth, if we can't make a claim for justice, then we really have no ability to advocate for the advancement of our society, for equitable policies, for the change that we need to really live up to our constitutional ideals. So this battle for truth is at the center of the fight for our future.
Now, you talk about it as a battle for truth. This has been framed in so many state legislatures as being about critical race theory, which I got to say, even in the most progressive districts, I can't imagine critical race theory, which was, of course, developed in law school education, being taught at a K-12 level. But what is it that is, let's take out that language of critical race theory, which actually designates something very specific, and talk about what is embattled here. When you say truth, what do you mean?
What I mean is an honest conversation about the origins of this country, which we know were founded on the subjugation of not just Black people, but also Indigenous persons. And our country has gone through many iterations in which it has discriminated against various groups of people who have immigrated to this country in different ways. And a recognition of how we came to be the incredibly diverse nation that we are is something that we should embrace. We should celebrate the evolution of our country from one that was founded on enslavement to one that now has the potential to be the most ambitious democratic experiment I think this planet has ever witnessed, if we would let it be. And that is really what the concern is to try to stifle the reality of our history and how it manifests in inequities today. And that's because it really brings attention to the power structure that is in place right now. And it causes people to question why certain systems exist in a way that continue to perpetuate discrimination. And I think it's a direct backlash to the thirst for knowledge and the appetite that was unleashed last year when we saw protests across the country around police violence, where citizens from different backgrounds and ethnicities and generations came together and began to have a collective understanding about discrimination and inequality in our society. And that caused some people to become very nervous and very scared, and therefore to try to suppress the truth about our history and the path forward.
I'm wondering about the ways that the history of LDF included really indicating the rights of students, of young people, of individuals to access equal opportunities for education, whether at the earliest levels all the way up through college and graduate school. And it seems like that typically law, at least, right, sort of that jurisprudence has focused on the rights of people to access these ideas. And I'm wondering, you know, kind of flipping that, right, the rights to ensure that these ideas are in the public sphere in order to be accessed.
That's right. I mean, we've done work around access to education throughout our history. And obviously, the most well-known case in that area is Brown versus Board of Education, which ended state-sponsored segregation in public schools. And the right to access information, the right to information, is something that the Supreme Court has recognized. It's something that really is foundational to our Constitution and our core principles of freedom of expression and freedom of thought. And this is something that we've also celebrated in our affirmative action work when we talk about the need for diversity in higher education, for there to be an exchange of ideas, for there to be a diverse class of persons learning together who can inform one another's perspectives. We know that that produces the best and highest performing society, the best, most productive workplaces. We know that our diversity is our strength. And what we're seeing in this current iteration of whitewashing and of an effort to suppress the truth is a stifling of that diversity. We're seeing an effort to ignore what I think is one of the most profound stories of transformation and evolution that can propel us forward.
Typically, when we think also about the foundational rights of democracy, voting is there at the core, right? This is how we know kind of the health of our democracy. Are these two things connected in any way?
Absolutely. I think that what we're seeing is a effort on at least three fronts to silence the majority of persons in this country from exercising their voice and being heard and effecting change that reflects their conditions. We're seeing an assault on the right to vote. We're seeing an assault on the right to protest. And we are also experiencing what we've been talking about, and that is an assault on truth. And all three of those work to silence the emerging majority of people of color in this country. And that is a very, very dangerous circumstance. It is laying a foundation and paving a way for minoritarian rule, for very anti-democratic and authoritarian regimes to take root. And it is a significant barrier to our ability to realize the promise of this country, to realize the promise of this multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy.
Let's talk a little bit more about voting rights. Clearly, despite many calls for and legislative possibilities and options, the U.S. Congress was unable, at least at this point, to pass meaningful voting rights legislation. We now have new maps drawn in many states across there's new maps in nearly every state across the country, and some are undoubtedly going to come up for challenge, maybe particularly Texas and Georgia. I'm wondering how you're feeling about our current realities around voting, particularly going into the midterm elections.
Well, I'm deeply concerned. We are in dire need of federal legislation to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which in my mind marks the first year that we became a real democracy. It was the first year in our history where all Americans were enabled to vote. And what we're seeing now is a Congress that has failed the American people, that has used the filibuster as a barrier to progress, to inclusion, to the expansion of the electorate that is absolutely necessary to make sure that we are reflecting the interests and the viewpoints of the majority of Americans who live in this country. What the Supreme Court said back in 1886 in a case called Yickwo versus Hopkins is as true today as it was then, and that is that the right to vote is preservative of all rights. If we don't have the right to vote, there's no way to protect and secure the other rights that we enjoy. And so this fight for the right to vote, this fight for federal legislation that will protect against partisan gerrymandering, that will protect against the manipulation of who gets to vote at the polls, that will ensure that basic principles like early voting are uniform, that fight is really critical to our ability to maintain this young democracy that we have. And we need two pieces of legislation to get us there, and that's the Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. And those are now currently being stalled in Congress.
Janae Nelson is Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and soon President. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Melissa. It was my pleasure.
Time for a pop quiz. Now, this is an easy one. It's just a repeat of the question you answered when you completed your census form last year. I mean, you did complete your census form, didn't you? Okay, here's the question. Choose the category that identifies your race. White, Black or African American, American Indian and Alaska Native, Asian, or Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander. Or you can choose two or more races. Cool, pencils down. All right, that was easy. Well, maybe. I mean, what box do you choose if your grandparents are from Algeria, Morocco, or Egypt? All those countries are part of the continent of Africa. Would that make you African American? What if your parents recently immigrated from Syria or Lebanon? Should you mark Asian? This is the experience Arab Americans face with each government-required questionnaire, from the census to college admissions to job applications.
Now, on the United States Census form, if you check some other race, And you put in an Arab country, do you know what happens to that form? Do you know what happens to that form? You know what they do with that form? They don't burn it. They don't give it to the FBI. They actually file it with white people. Did you know that? Yes. According to the federal government, we're white. White. Scary, right? For you, not for us.
That was comedian Amer Zaher, finding some humor in the distance between how Arab Americans see themselves and how the federal government identifies and responds to the community. shunting Arab Americans into the category of white Americans, but then treating them as not quite Americans. And it isn't a new problem. Back in the early 20th century, the Department of Justice heard a case on whether people from the Middle East could claim they were white in order to be allowed U.S. citizenship, or if they were Asian, which meant they could not. George Shashim, the Arab American on trial, told the court that he came from the same place as Jesus. So, of course, the ruling found that people from the Middle East were now white. Whoa. But advocates say that people from the Middle East have since become invisible in the U.S. as a result. And for decades, Arab American organizations have pushed the federal government to adjust official forms to stop what they say is an erasure of a community. But the question is, just who is a person of color? And are Arab Americans part of that group? For more, I spoke with historian and professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California, Sarah Gualtieri, and Maya Berry, the executive director of the Arab American Institute. Maya started off by explaining the internal and external identifications of Arab Americans as people of color.
I actually talk about it exactly that way. I start by explaining that there is our identity, how we identify as individuals, and not even collectively, right? There's the sense of how each individual Arab American will identify, and then this externally imposed classification on us that comes from other sources. We're talking about a community of roughly 3.7 million Arab Americans in this country, and they identify with their national origin and ethnicity, and they don't fit in nicely into the racial classifications in terms of how people at least understand this. There are Black Arabs, there are white Arabs, there are brown Arabs, so it's a lot like the Latino community in terms of ethnicity and not necessarily a racial classification. And then we have this burden of being a community that's really often misunderstood for a variety of reasons that I trust we'd get into, but it does play into how this conversation plays out.
Yeah, Sarah, I think I just kind of want to ask you similarly this question of both internal self-identification and external identification of Arab Americans as people of color.
Yes, well, when I look at the, you know, over 150-year history of Arab American experience of race in the United States, I see so many instances of racial terror that I can't help but understand their experience as being that of a minoritized population. So very sadly, I could spend this entire segment enumerating cases of racial violence from the 1929 lynching of a Lebanese grocer in Florida, to the 1985 assassination of Alex Ode, who was the West Coast Regional Director of the Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, or the 2015 murder of three Arab Muslim college students in Chapel Hill. So I understand this violence, like as a historian, I understand this violence to be fueled by ideas about their difference from a group of people understood to be white American. And I think that historically there has always been this tension whereby Arabs have been pulled out through external factors. They've been pulled out of this category of American. And I think that is where we find ourselves in a very fraught situation, and where you have longstanding communities in the United States who are quintessentially American, and yet there is a perception that they are always outsiders.
So this is interesting. And I'm wondering about the moments when that difference gets highlighted. Sarah, as a historian, maybe you can walk us through a few of the key historical moments, and then Maya, I'll come to you as well.
So what makes this conversation so interesting and nuanced, I think, is that there are moments in which Arab communities do access the privileges of whiteness, right? So if we're trying to understand this disconnect, you know, why is it that when you look at the census that Arabs are expected to classify themselves as white, and yet the lived experience of so many Arab Americans is clearly not as white citizens? Where does that disconnect come from? So in the early part of the 20th century, race was so connected to ideas of citizenship. There was, in fact, a racial requirement for citizenship briefly, the George Chisholm case is a really interesting case that unfolded here in Los Angeles in 1909. And one of the reasons I like to talk about this case is because there tends to be a perception that questions of race and racial identity as they relate to Arab Americans, particularly in this early part of the 20th century, that they unfolded particularly in the Jim Crow South. And the Chisholm case points to the fact that these debates were unfolding nationwide, right? So George Chisholm was a police officer in Venice, California. He arrested a young person and was at first unable to give testimony in court against him because it was deemed that George Chisholm was not a white person. And this drew on earlier legislation that basically said that people of color, or the language of the statute doesn't use that term, but Chinese, Black people, they could not give testimony in court against a white person. And so George Chisholm decides to get his naturalization, to get his citizenship, and to do so by conforming to the statute, which meant litigating his status as a white person.
Maya, I'm wondering if you can speak a bit to that, that sense of allyship, perhaps in the most recent moment, although 20 years now is perhaps not that recent, but I'm thinking the ways that again, the post 9/11 moment ends up conflating in American discourse, Arab American identity, Muslim identity, and then this kind of outsider status.
For me, the issue, it really does predate even the post 9/11 environment that we see. You know, I always start with Richard Nixon's Operation Boulder and the targeting of Arab students in this country who are engaged in advocacy for Palestinian human rights. It's been a defining issue in terms of the political exclusion that we've faced. And you know, the context of your question, right, is American identity white is part of what we're kind of talking about. Now, my answer is no, right? But the way that it's played out, particularly in a post 2016 presidential election, there's like this new way to understand Du Bois's new religion of whiteness, right? Like there's, and the way we fit into that is so interesting, partly for me based on this most recent election of the mayoral candidate in Boston, who is an Arab American woman who had to deal with a headline that said, "Boston mayoral candidate says she's a person of color. Is she?" So as a community, we are literally rendered invisible by government data. We have been fighting to get a new category on the census, a Middle East and North Africa category that would allow us to go in and collect more accurate information about Arab Americans for decades. We were there for 2020 until, regrettably, the Trump administration politicized the census in an unprecedented way. And then the category, movement on the category, was abandoned, though it was tested in 2015 and found to be a proper way, a more accurate way to gather data on this. So we're rendered invisible in that, and then highly visible and targeted by government policies that have securitized us as a community that our fellow Americans sort of need to view us as differently. So for me, when I talk about these issues, it's like I have these four buckets I put it in. And I always start with the identity piece, because I think that's really important, which is how I choose to identify, maybe different than how Sarah does or how you do, Melissa. And that's the point of this conversation. We get to choose that. But there's a second piece of it, which is how we're classified by our government. And the issue of the census is just critical. It's done real and tangible harm to local communities when we don't have the appropriate data to be able to provide things like English as a second language program to appropriate political representation. But there's also the way we're seen by others, the way we're perceived by our other fellow Americans, right? And I gotta tell you, for the first time, we do a lot of polling on American attitudes. And for the first time ever that we got to the point of the majority of Americans not having a negative view of Arab Americans was in 2017, where we finally broke to 52%. And by the way, that's
when had that question first been asked?
We started doing polling on American attitudes in the late 90s, tracking it exactly the same way from 2010. But we've asked it differently dating back to the 90s. And I'll tell you, it broke at 52%. When we asked the question about Arabs, not Arab Americans, we didn't break 50. It was still at 42%. So this anti-Arab bigotry is real. And it's part of It's part of what we have to deal with. And then the final point I would make is in terms of my buckets of understanding this is that there's an element here in terms of how we're treated by state power, how we are profiled, how we're viewed in the context of counterterrorism policies, how we're talked about when it comes to immigration policies. And when we talk about, you know, working in coalition with partners, the profiling guidance that's in place right now continues to allow profiling on border security, national security, and local law enforcement.
I want to, I'm going to come back to you, Sarah, to talk a little bit about sort of what you hinted at previously around acts of violence. You told us a few of them. Some of them are quite familiar to me, others not so much. I'm wondering if you could, and again, this is tough to do, but if you could help us to understand sort of, at least in the past maybe two or three decades, a reflection on state violence. And then we can talk a bit also about citizen-on-citizen violence.
I think in the case of Arab Americans, you so often seen this kind of this pairing of violence that is carried out against individual Arab Americans. So a woman is walking down the street in Chicago and her hijab is pulled off her head, or she's spat upon. Or so we might characterize that as a individualized violence carried out by one person upon another. But I think that what's important to hold on to here is that those acts of violence, those incidences of hate that are common, frequent, carried out in multiple locations, that they are fueled by these policies, by policies of exclusion, particularly at the federal level, the Muslim ban, for example, that feeds into a kind of American imaginary of in which Arab Americans are thought of, as I've mentioned before, as other, as perpetually foreign, right? So I think that it's hard to disentangle the issue of sort of individual violence or hate incidences carried out on the bodies of Arab Americans from larger policies, including policies that are international, right? So this question of how do we understand the racialized experience of Arab Americans, in my view, has to be understood with a transnational lens. I mean, we have Arab Americans in this country for many reasons, but one of them is because so many of their families have been rendered refugees by American state policy, and most especially the carrying out of wars against Arab populations.
Maya, I wanted to come back to you on the issues that you'd begun to lay out for us around the census. Can you say a bit more about the campaign to include new categories and what that could mean for Arab American communities?
Oh, absolutely. It'd be transformative. When I say rendered invisible in the data, it is because there has been a massive undercount of our community historically. And so anywhere from medical research, we believe there's a higher prevalence of diabetes in our community. And we have medical researchers who tell us, I don't know what the denominator is. I can't conduct accurate research on our community because I don't know, you know, how to get that number. And I have to actually just mention this additional point because Sarah was talking about hate crimes. And we do a great deal of work on hate crimes. Arab Americans were part of the reason, when you look at the Hate Crime Statistics Act that was passed back in 1990, we're actually part of the reason for the passage of that act. There were congressional hearings looking at a then FBI director deemed Arab Americans as being in what he called a zone of danger. We were literally targeted with extreme violence. And Sarah mentioned the murder of civil rights advocate Alex Oda was part of that. And at the time, we had something called Code 31, which was a category for anti-Arab hate, and it existed in the other categories. We lost that category for reasons that are not clear to us. As hate crime data progressed from 1990 until 2015, there was no anti-Arab hate category that could be tracked. So when you ask me the question about our polling and how far it went back to, I can only cite you hate crime data on Arab Americans starting in 2015. So we go back to when it's time to, in a post 9/11 environment, institute a program like NSEERS and target people from Arab countries and deport countless numbers of Arab men back to the Arab world, we can find them. When it comes time to identifying victims of hate crimes, when it comes time to allocating trillions of dollars of government resources tied to census data, we can't find us.
That was Executive Director of the Arab American Institute, Maya Berry, and Historian and Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC, Sarah Gualtieri. Maya, Sarah, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. It's been a pleasure to be with you today. And also, thank you, Maya.
I'm so grateful for the conversation. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Melissa. And I think that for a community that's often ignored, the importance of talking about this with your viewers is really appreciated. Thank you so much.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Okay, check this out. A report from the Reflective Democracy Campaign, documented by Politico earlier this year, revealed that the Asian American and Pacific Islander community is the least represented demographic in American politics, making up less than 1% of all those who hold office. But that may be starting to change. 2021 has been a historic election year for AAPI communities.
One of my sons asked me the other night if boys can be elected mayor in Boston. They have been, and they will again someday, but not tonight.
That was Michelle Wu, who's just elected as Boston's next mayor. She's the first Asian American and the first woman elected to this role. Aftab Purval was elected as Cincinnati's first Asian American mayor. And five Asian Americans were elected to the New York City Council this year, the largest number of Asian Americans ever to serve together on the council. But the wins have been hard-fought, and they come after nearly 2 years of struggle with the rise of anti-Asian hate in the country. Despite being the fastest-growing ethnic group in the country, misconceptions about the AAPI community linger, with parts of the AAPI community finding themselves discursively erased in the narrative. For more on this week's historic wins and the issues that members of the AAPI community care about, I spoke with Jane Jun, a professor at the University of Southern California, and Arun Venugopal, who is a senior reporter in the Race and Justice Unit at WNYC. Professor Jun began by giving her analysis on the Boston mayoral race.
Boston is, you know, old school, right, in terms of old Democratic Party politics. But the point here is it was super surprising. This young woman who is, I think prior to that, served on the council and was the president of the council, but prior to that didn't have other political experience. But it's not only a combination of the freshness of the candidate and the newness of the issues, but the progressive coalition that she is bringing, uniting groups that otherwise I think would be difficult to see together and we haven't seen together prior to that in Boston politics.
Yeah. Arun, in New York, voters chose five Asian American candidates for city council, including the first two South Asian elected officials. What does this mean for these communities in New York?
Well, I'll give you one example, Melissa. Jackson Heights is known as one of the most diverse, if not the most diverse neighborhood in the world. I mean, there's something like 165, 170 languages spoken in this neighborhood. It's never had, to my knowledge, a non-white council member representing this district. And now its incoming council member, Shekhar Krishnan, becomes that first person. He is a person of Indian, South Asian descent. His parents moved here decades ago. And so he represents this shift. in political power for South Asians, for people who come from immigrant communities. And that required not just appealing to South Asians in the neighborhood and the district, also building coalitions with people from the Latino community, with white liberals, with immigrants, speaking Spanish to them, reaching out. Same thing with another candidate who just won in Brooklyn. Her name is Shahana Hanif. She's the first Muslim woman to be entering the city council. She appealed through Bangla to this significant proportion of Bangla residents. She used her mom. They had this whole parallel campaign. So all these tactics are being deployed. It's not just about changing demographics. It's about how do you reach these people? How do you engage them and sort of speak to them in a meaningful way?
So I hear, Jane, to come back to you, I hear you talking about this progressive coalition, and I hear Arun talking about kind of this new and fresh and way of speaking across these divisions. But I got to say, I lived in Louisiana under Bobby Jindal, and I have been a Nikki Haley watcher for a long time. And I want to just sort of dig in a little bit on any kind of maybe challenging any kind of presumption that the broadly diverse category that is AAPI, much less AAPI elected officials, are all necessarily progressive.
In the 2020 election, two women from California, Michelle Steele and Young Kim, both representing Orange County and parts of it, both defeated Democrats who won in the 2018 interim midterm elections. They're both Republicans and very strong Republicans. So even in California, there is a diversity of opinions and certainly a diversity of party loyalties.
And so, Arun, it brings me to kind of this challenge around both descriptive and substantive representation that I think often emerges for communities of color. Sometimes has been talked about candidates who are not men, or also queer candidates. How do we balance both the like very real need for and desire for descriptive representation and sort of an interest in one's own ideological representation?
Well, I think this is part of the challenge, and you're seeing this playing out in different ways. Just take the term South Asian itself. Now, this is actually a contested term. It's not like everybody who arrives from, say, Nepal or Bangladesh or Pakistan comes and says, I'm a South Asian. It is sort of a socialized process by which people come to embrace a somewhat progressive kind of a set of ideas. And that can sort of manifest in many different ways. But when people refer to themselves as South Asians, there is a certain kind of reaching across the aisle process saying, like, I may be Indian American, but and maybe I'm Hindu, but I actually believe in fighting Islamophobia, for instance, or not just ascribing to model minority sort of notions, you know, the success narrative, and perhaps talking about class solidarity as well, showing up for taxi drivers in the case of New York City, where some of these council members who are South Asian were on the front lines, they were taking part in hunger strikes because they realized it's very important to do the work of fighting against class exploitation, labor exploitation. And then you have other candidates around the country who basically don't necessarily, you know, they live in much more, you know, segregated neighborhoods. They may be seen as good non-white candidates, and they work for certain systems. When Jane was referring to Young Kim and others, you know, it struck me. I remember, like, right after the Atlantic killings earlier this year, those congressional hearings addressing hate crimes against Asian Americans, and a bunch of Asian American men and women in office, they sort of towed the party line, the Republican Party line, that, you know, the real problem really isn't all this hate crime. It's really access to higher education and the Ivy Leagues, where they're like fighting us. So it was to me at the time, if you call me naive, it was kind of stunning right after the Atlanta shootings to see that. But you see this other formation happening too. And so these things are playing out increasingly. There are people who definitely speak to, I guess, the power and maintaining power and white supremacy and those kinds of things in new ways, and others who are pushing back.
Now, Jane, I'm interested in thinking not only about some of these wins for candidates, and actually we have a few more to talk about, but also about Asian American voters, AAPI voters as voters. And, you know, obviously everyone is dissecting in a million different ways what happened in the Virginia gubernatorial election. But I'm wondering if you see any role that could have been played that wasn't by AAPI voters in Virginia, or that in fact manifested and helped to make this decision decision for a Republican governor in that state.
I don't know that it was a huge surprise, the outcome of that election. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to juxtapose that potentially with New Jersey. And then also, let's think back to the special 2020 election for the Senate races in 21 in Georgia, where Asian American voters are credited in that state with helping to push two Democrats over the top. I think it's a little bit early to say where we don't have great exit poll data or really great data at all to find out where and how Asian American voters were mobilized and if they were indeed mobilized for whom. The size of the population of AAPI voters in both Virginia and New Jersey is larger than in Georgia. And so they form, I think, an important potential swing group of swing voters. And it's important to emphasize the notion of swing because while Arun is correct, Asian Americans tend to lean Democratic, particularly Indian Americans, who I will note are among the largest immigrant Asian groups in the United States, but also among the newest, with the majority of them arriving in the United States after 1996. You're always going to find Indians who've been here for longer than that, but for the most part, they're a relatively new population and have been much more socialized to Democratic politics. On the flip side, you'll see groups like Vietnamese Americans who vote much more Republican than certainly Indians, and in general, more Republican overall. It helps to account for why you see the wins among, even if tight wins, among Republican candidates in Orange County, which has a large Vietnamese population. So overall, I think it's a little bit early to say the role that Asian Americans played, but note that swing voters are not only people that just decide to change their mind from one election to another, but they might also be swing voters because they're just not sure about the politics yet. And the politics in this meaning, which party do they belong to? One of the largest categories within a frequency distribution of partisanship among Asian Americans is no preference, not sure, independent. And this is in part because the majority of Asian American voters in the United States are not native born, but foreign born. They're naturalized citizens. It takes a little while to become knowledgeable about politics in the United States.
Arun, I want to sort of zero in just a bit more on South Asians who you've been sort of talking about and giving us some reflections on. What do you think is sort of most frequently misrepresented or misunderstood in media conversations around voters, in addition to elected officials, but voters who are South Asian?
Well, I certainly think that most people can't grasp the incredible diversity within this term. I mean, we're talking about 1.5 to 1.7 billion people, I'm just saying off the top of my head, in that region of South Asia that we're representing incredible linguistic diversity, incredible range of, say, educational experiences, languages, all of these things, and just like socio-political backgrounds are coming from. And when they come here, although that we have this sort of notion that many of them are highly educated in this country, that many of them are, making well above the median American income, which many of them are. How do you sort of square that with the fact that many are also in working class neighborhoods? They may be struggling to put, food on the table. They may be dealing with assault, indignities, humiliation, on the street or in the workplace or whatever, in ways that many people don't necessarily see or hear about because those stories are not being elevated or told. There's such a range that it's a very unwieldy term. And I don't think we, broadly speaking, really know how to, I mean, even in the community, it's a very kind of like, do we really use this term or not? South Asian as well as Asian American, unwieldy, but so I think that's the problem, that people don't necessarily know how to square the idea of the Indian American doctor making, like $500,000 a year with the person who is an undocumented immigrant in Queens, who has a totally different set of problems and ambitions and ideas of what they're dealing with.
Yeah, I'm reminded of recent data showing that in terms of income inequality, that it's actually grown most rapidly within, so internal to that broad and diverse category that is AAPI, right? That and so if you think just of income as indicating sort of one understanding of a group of people, right, that both the highest one-fifth and the lowest, quintile represented, with this kind of broad category. It's such an odd, like, again, in the American racial binary, right? Sort of what we do with AAPI as a political identity.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's going to be a long time before we understand, even within AAPI issues, like how formative this pandemic is going to be. I think it's going to take time for us to understand that. I'm just thinking of one of these five new Asian Americans entering the city council in New York City. One of them, Julie Wan, I met her at a protest against anti-Asian violence that happened earlier this year. She wasn't there by herself. She was there with a companion, a non-Asian companion, who she said is her sort of bodyguard, like one of several. She says, I don't leave my home without a non-Asian companion because I feel so unsafe. I've also taken up jujitsu, which I started learning as a kid. But that sense of threat, of potential violence, it's very real for a lot of people in the community. And I think also it's sort of a very fast and harsh sort of a training in, the history of this country and what imperialism means and how, like, you can be three or four generations into living here, but you're still otherized, as we saw all too, clearly with what's happened with the so-called Chinese flu, this kind of stuff that's deployed so easily. I think these are the issues that are really going to, potentially drive young people who are coming of age at this moment and convince them that the only way to change these things is to acquire power.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
That was Professor Jane Jun from the University of Southern California and Arun Venugopal, senior reporter in the Race and Justice Unit at WNYC. Have a safe and a fun new year. This year has been trying. Actually, it's kind of been rough for a few years here. So we here at The Takeaway, we get it. We're feeling it too. So we're sending you lots of positive vibes for 2022. If you missed anything today or from the past year, check out our podcast. It's available where you get all your other audio. Just be sure to give us a like and subscribe. And of course, call us and share what got you into the new year. Or let us know your resolutions, if you've got any. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.